This is scary stuff.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. When a bank that's been around since before the Civil War is on the verge of collapse, there's a problem. This morning, Lehman Brothers said it's going to lose about $4 billion this quarter. And the bank's executives pitched some ideas for saving the company. If they don't, we could see another bailout. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
Lehman Brothers' exposure to bad mortgage loans has it struggling to survive. On a conference call this morning, Lehman's CEO Richard Fuld said real estate losses and public scrutiny have clouded the company's underlying value. Fuld says Lehman will sell off $25 billion worth of commercial mortgages into a new company.
We put a concrete plan in place to exit the vast majority of our commercial real estate.
It'll also sell a majority stake in its investment management division and slash its annual dividend. Portfolio manager Kurt Brunner at the Swarthmore Group says this fire sale will attract some buyers from private equity firms. At least that's the hope. Brunner says the big question will be,
can Lehman fail or will Lehman be allowed to fail? And I think the answer is the same, and the answer is no.
Brunner says the government would likely step in to stop the financial chaos if Lehman can't stay afloat, just like it did this summer with investment bank Bear Stearns. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Lehman shares are down 80% this year. Fannie and Freddie will be kicked off the S&P 500 at the close of trading today. S&P requires a market cap of $5 billion, and Fannie and Freddie are well short of that. Looks like the two companies that will replace them are Salesforce.com and Fastenal, an industrial supplies maker. Cautiously optimistic about the Lehman plan. The Dow is up 74 points to 11,304. The NASDAQ up 22. The S&P 500 has gained 9. In Japan today, the Nikkei closed 0.5% lower. European shares are down a fraction so far. Today, OPEC decided to take action on the price of oil. The cartel cut production by 500,000 barrels a day. Joining us now is Javier Blas. He covers energy for the Financial Times. Javier, what's OPEC up to here?
Well, I think that OPEC was concerned that oil prices could fall well below $100, and they decided the best option for them was to send a clear message to the market that they were ready to defend high oil prices. So obviously, OPEC is marking a line on the market, and $100 is now that line.
Now, Javier, I remember not too long ago when OPEC was worried that the price of oil might go above $80 a barrel and kill demand. Now we're still above $100. What has changed?
What has changed is that OPEC still sees very, very strong demand. In China, India, Brazil, the Middle East, Russia, demand is growing very, very fast. Mm-hmm. And what OPEC has realized is that we have seen very strong demand with very high oil prices.
And you said the barrier here is $100. That's what you think OPEC is looking at in terms of propping up the price of oil?
For some OPEC members, in particular Venezuela, Iran, probably Nigeria, $100 now is the minimum price. I will say that Saudi Arabia and other countries will not see any problem if prices drop below $100, but they stay somewhere between $80 and $90. But wherever is the line, it is very clear that OPEC today is defending a much higher price than used a year ago.
All right, Javier Blas from the Financial Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the Morning Report for Wednesday, September 10th on Marketplace.org. Remember plans to use radar, cameras, and motion detectors at the Mexican border? Federal dollars have been pouring into that project, but we, the taxpayers, might not be getting what we're paying for. Congress holds a hearing on this today. We have more from Steve Henn.
In spring of 2006, officials unveiled plans for a high-tech virtual fence along the U.S.-Mexico border. President Bush called it the most technologically advanced border security initiative in American history. But it hasn't quite worked out that way.
The radars were thrown off by raindrops and blowing mesquite leaves. The cameras didn't go the distance.
Rich Stana is with the Government Accountability Office. He says the Department of Homeland Security was supposed to have rolled out stretches of this virtual fence in Arizona and Texas by the end of the year.
Back in February, that was extended to 2011.
And DHS is expected to announce more delays today. The government already set aside more than $1 billion for the fence, and that figure is likely to climb. Stana says none of the high-tech systems deployed along an original 28-mile section of fence work well enough to keep. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Jefferson County, Alabama has some serious financial problems. Today, local banks will meet with the county. They're hoping to find a way to avoid one of the biggest municipal bankruptcies in more than a decade. From WBHM in Birmingham, Tanya Ott reports.
The clock is ticking. Okay, it's actually been ticking several months now. The county has $3.2 billion in sewer debt. The county's already missed several bond payment deadlines, and without a recent extension, it would have faced penalties and interest of $1 million a day. Wall Street isn't pushing Jefferson into bankruptcy court. The banks could lose money if that happens. But everyone's getting anxious. George Bowman is a Jefferson County commissioner.
No one wants to see this county go bankrupt. And whatever we can do to forestall that, the governor has stepped in to say he's going to give it his best shot.
Some analysts say bankruptcy might be the best option. It worked for Orange County, California back in 1994. But that might be like comparing California's oranges to Alabama's cotton. Orange County has one of the higher median incomes in the country, while 15% of Jefferson County's residents live below the poverty line. In Birmingham, I'm Tanya Ott for Marketplace.
Where in the world is the best place to do business? It's probably a tough call. One thing that does attract companies is business-friendly regulation. The World Bank just did a survey on this, and some unexpected places are at the top of the list. Azerbaijan, Albania, Belarus. Marketplace's John Dimsdale explains.
Eastern Europe has gradually overtaken fast-growing East Asia as the region with the most regulatory reform. The World Bank report called Doing Business 2009 looks at 10 categories, such as how easy it is to start a business, get a license, hire workers, or file for bankruptcy. Some African countries are showing improvements, like Senegal and Burkina Faso, but the stars are countries just east of the European Union. Sabine Hertfeld, the report's co-author, says these countries have a special incentive to reform.
One of the factors that are driving this is, of course, the integration in the European Union, which makes certain reforms necessary to join the EU.
Georgia made the up-and-coming list, too, but that was before the Russian invasion. On the overall ease of doing business list ranking 181 economies, Singapore, New Zealand, and the United States are the top three for the third year in a row. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If you Google the word foreclosure, all kinds of ads pop up. Stop foreclosure fast or save your home today. But as you might imagine, there's a lot of empty promises in there. Here's Elisa Roth.
Joy owns her house in Queens, New York. But Fridays are the only time she actually sleeps there. She works three jobs as a home health worker or a nurse's aide to try to make her mortgage payments.
To tell the truth, I really want to God to help me to have the house back. That's all. We're going to get attached to it, you know.
She's owned the house for 30 years, but got sick a couple of years ago.
I failed to pay the mortgage.
The mortgage servicer wouldn't negotiate. She was terrified she'd lose her house. A friend told her about a company called Home Savers. The owner promised to save her house. All she had to do, he said, was sign over the deed for a year. It's a classic scam.
What they don't tell the person is that they're transferring their deed.
Jessica Addy is an attorney with the nonprofit South Brooklyn Legal Services.
The person to whom they're transferring it is taking out a much bigger mortgage on their house and cashing out all the equity, and then there's no way that the original homeowner can get their home back.
That's exactly what happened to Joy. Home Savers took out a new, much bigger mortgage. Joy's monthly payments doubled to more than $4,000 a month. Addie says she sees cases like this one all the time. The scammers use all kinds of tricks, like knocking on people's doors, visiting churches, bombarding victims with flyers promising to save their homes. New York has joined a handful of other states in passing new laws to make it harder to get away with these kinds of scams. But law or not, once a homeowner signed over the deed, or worse, it can be very hard to get the house back. Addie says the real trick is not to get tricked at all.
When you're in foreclosure, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have no options. Some of these people, if they had come to our office, we could have helped them refinance into a lower interest loan.
But Joy says in a desperate moment, that's advice easier given than followed.
Même when you're in trouble, no matter what people tell you they're going to help you, you just see the help. You don't see the consequences. You just see, well, you're going to help me, that's fine. No, that's all. That's the way you get me.
She has a lawyer now and is hoping to get her house back before the new owner manages to flip it to somebody else. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
I told you yesterday that car makers were looking for some help from Congress with low-interest loans. The CEO of Ford said Detroit is not looking for a bailout. Commentator Will Wilkinson says you can call it whatever you want, it's still an undue burden on taxpayers.
Detroit's big three automakers are struggling. Instead of making cars Americans want to buy, GM, Ford, and Chrysler are clamoring for tens of billions in taxpayer-subsidized government loans. Sadly, these subprime borrowers will likely get their cheap money. Both McCain and Obama are backing the bailout, lest the American public be visited with the calamitous extinction of the Pontiac Vibe and Chrysler Sebring. Just this week, the government took over mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. This put taxpayers explicitly on the hook for their massive liabilities. And earlier this year, the Fed opened the spigot to keep flailing investment houses afloat. There's a decent argument for these interventions. In each case, quick action might have kept these medium-sized disasters from snowballing and bringing down the whole economy. If so, the extravagant expense is worth it. But what if one or all of the big three fail? Well, other companies will buy their assets and use them more wisely and profitably. Some people will lose jobs, most will find new ones, and the gains in efficiency will make the economic pie larger and job growth more likely. Maybe you'll buy a Toyota Camry made in Kentucky. We'll pull through. Here's a paradox for you. Government guarantees often create the very conditions they are meant to guard against. The implicit guarantee behind the privately owned yet government-sponsored Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac contributed to the irrational risk-taking in the mortgage industry that has pushed our economy to the brink. When individuals and firms are made to bear the costs of their own decisions, their decisions will be more carefully made. Detroit doesn't need taxpayer-subsidized loans. It needs to make better decisions, or else fail. The alternative to creative destruction is not stable prosperity. Propping up yesteryear's winners leads to stagnation at best, plain old uncreative destruction at worst. The best defense is often no defense. But politicians, who can see no further than the next election, have once again placed our bank accounts in harm's way.
Will Wilkinson is with the Cato Institute. You can find a link to his blog and share your thoughts at marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.